I was offered the opportunity of signing on for more public service, and I couldn't say no. You don't choose the moment. Very often the moment chooses you.
That's Bob Carr on accepting the post as Australia's foreign minister. In that press conference, he referred to an item that he flung at his bookshelf.
Yeah, I've been through a few of them, being reshuffled, and I remember some sort of rage or frustration as Premier not getting away with a wayward colleague actually picking up a porcelain mug with a portrait of Chairman Mao just to demonstrate my foreign policy credentials and flinging it at the bookcase. And there's still, apparently in Barry O'Farrell's office on the 40th floor, there's still a dent, an historic dent in that bookcase. By those standards, this reshuffle was a mild affair. It was played by Marquess of Queensbury rules.
After Bob Carr resigned as New South Wales Premier, he published My Reading Life, a memoir about the books that shaped his thinking. I spoke to him about it in 2008, and in this excerpt, it's not long before we get right down to questions of faith and God.
The American books, so we've got something on just about every US president, with big representations on Lincoln and Roosevelt, of course, who are my all-time favourites.
And holding up a couple of books there is Chairman Mao.
Yeah, that's grotesque and ironic. I revile him as a bloodthirsty dictator, but I haven't been able to resist the kitsch of these porcelain figures out of the Cultural Revolution, which you can buy in every junk store in Hong Kong.
It's amazing. There are, what, five of them there. Can you describe them?
One's Mao at his desk, penning his aphorisms for the Little Red Book. Mao in a great coat, waving at the crowds, I presume from Tiananmen Gate, and big ones of Mao in his uniform. One of the books I recommend is Yuan Cheng's biography of Mao Zedong, which is a devastating and emotional portrait of a tyrant. Yeah, all these Mao figures have got ironic intent.
Now, in this book, you've taken the voice of a wise guide, sometimes a wise guy. Who are you advising in this? Is it your younger self, or who is it?
Very much so. This is a book I wished that I had had when I was 30 or 40 and restless in my reading choices, suspecting that I was lazy in devouring so much current affairs, contemporary fiction, spy stories, and a bit of detective stuff. And wanting someone to guide me into the forbidding world of harder literature or the classics. So I had to wrestle with these books, and I wanted to write a book which tells readers, for example, that War and Peace is not that hard. Don't give up because of 20 pages that represent a welter of Russian names. I just think readers can benefit from having a bit of encouragement and a few notions about an otherwise formidable book. I would have appreciated it.
Now, you've read so widely, and it's impossible for me to discuss with you the whole range of books that you've written about, but I'm particularly interested in the ones that wrestle with the meaning of life, with the spiritual, the moral, the existential questions. And you begin with Primo Levi's If This Is a Man, and also The Truce. You admit that you had to overcome a certain resistance to reading another book about the Holocaust. There is a lot of resistance to that around, isn't there?
Yes, and this was in the early 80s, a long time ago now. I picked it up and it fell open at a passage where he describes the sound of the barracks or the huts at night. All the prisoners are asleep and they're all dreaming of food, so they're moving their jaws. And you hear the sound of people moving their jaws. Of course that's the case, but he brings our attention to that, and it's such physicality that he brings to assessing the concentration camp experience. The book is full of magical insights and of short portraits of people, most of them murdered, who he encountered on that experience. The tone, hard to describe, really renders the book very special, so if you feel you don't want the experience of another book that details what horror is like, consider Primo Levi, because there is something magical about it. I think of all the literatures, of all the books that deal with this experience of the last 100 years out of holocausts and genocides and political repression, this is the best, this is the one I'd recommend above all?
The question, where was God, emerges out of the ashes of Auschwitz. Is Auschwitz for you a kind of crucible for that question, for belief in God?
Yes, it is very much so. And as a symbol for other things, other evils that exist and show that God was silent. And it drives me, again in the first chapter of the book, to recommend The Brothers Karamazov, a book I would have struggled with. But if someone had explained to me, this book is about characters having a debate, in particular two brothers, one a young monk, Alosha, and the other a skeptic, an atheist from the city, called Ivan, sitting down in a corner of an inn, and Ivan saying, I want to tell you some things about the suffering of children. Let's leave aside other aspects of the suffering of humanity. Let's just confine ourselves to what Russian children have been through. And he takes some newspaper clippings out of his pocket, and he reads some horrifying stories. And he says, even if I accept that your God, Alosha, talking to his brother, does exist, I've got to reject the world where the suffering of children is required as part of God's plan.
Who do you think wins that debate?
Well, this is why any of us should read this novel, to find out who wins. I think Dostoevsky puts devastatingly eloquent arguments in the mouth of Ivan, the skeptic, the brother who cannot accept a universe where the suffering of children is required by God. But Dostoevsky orchestrates a situation where a mystical commitment to God is presented through the life of an old monk, Zosima, who the young Karamazov finds very inspiring. In the end, Ivan is driven mad through the convenient fictional device of a cunning devil appearing to render him somewhat deranged, so he's removed from the scene. In the last pages, and Dostoevsky wrote this close to his own death, the young monk organises a scene of reconciliation, and it's a very powerful message. If you can't accept the young monk's Christian view of the universe, you're still overpowered by the description of what some people might describe as universal love or reconciliation.
So reconciliation wins out over the idea of a God who is in charge, the omnipotent God. It seems to me that sort of a God is always going to fail to rescue those who are distraught by the suffering of mankind.
In my book, I survey some of the literature that deals with God after Auschwitz, a subject that has interested me since I heard an Israeli theologian speak about it at the Hakoa Club in Sydney many years ago. And there's no satisfactory answer here, but it does bring us in to the book of Job, which lays down the unavoidable interpretation. The only way through this is unquestioning acceptance of God's will, obedience to God, even when we can't explain it. Now, for many people, including me, this is really an impossible requirement. I've got to say, we must think more about this biblical God before we can say to him, I obey you uncritically and in all circumstances.
Gosh, I think of so many of the figures in the Hebrew Bible, including Job, as being not so much obedient but rebellious.
That's certainly interesting. The God, though, seems to lay down this requirement of obedience. I suppose you could say the theme that unites the stories of the Bible is that constant argument between man and God. But as I see it, that God is one who does insist on obedience. Surely if the book of Job means anything, it is that. But there's a theme of rebelliousness, and that's one of the Jews' gifts to the world.
Well, in the Russia after Dostoevsky, obedience to God is replaced by obedience to the state. And the eyewitness who comes to the fore there is Solzhenitsyn. What was it like for you as a young social democrat reading the Gulag Archipelago?
It confirmed for me everything I believed about the Marxist-Leninists. And I wanted to pick up that book and Robert Conquest's The Great Terror and force it under the noses of people I knew in the trade union movement who had a benign view of the Soviet Union. And I think in the 1970s there are a lot of people on the on the broader left of politics who were forced up against the reality of socialist state power by what Solzhenitsyn presented. I mean, effectively he was saying that doing anything with Marx's vision of the world requires slave labour camps. So there was a great education of the left in the 1970s, and it goes back to Solzhenitsyn's reality. He presented the undeniable facts. You can't talk about Marxism by itself anymore without reference to the reality he described, behind the barbed wire, on the beaten earth, people being frozen and starved. That's the reality of our experiment with a socialist future.
That's an excerpt from a longer interview with Bob Carr, which can be heard by clicking a link on the Spirit of Things website. This is RN, where you can find programs on just about everything, so go to the RN website and have a browse. Also, upload your poetry and spiritual diary entries onto Pool. You'll find a link on the Spirit of Things website and details of the music you heard today by the Hilliard Ensemble. Production was by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering by Michelle Goldsworthy. Next week, put on your espadrilles. We're going to Rome. The Sistine Chapel was completed 500 years ago by Michelangelo, and we find out why it's still the most visited work of religious art. And treasures from the Vatican's secret archives are on display. And bring your mobile phone, because there's a special exhibition app. I'm Rachel Kahn, and with me will be veteran BBC Rome correspondent David Willey. We'll be your guides next week on The Spirit of Things, right here on RN.